Good evening, I'm Marshall. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Marshall.
And that's the only thing I am and do that qualifies me to be here. If I ain't one, I don't need to be here. I drank myself into this position. I didn't come here because I wanted to meet you nice folks. I didn't come here because I was, you know, having marital problems or employment problems or relationship problems or child-rearing problems or those kinds of things, although I did have all those problems. And initially when I came here, that's what I wanted to talk about. What the old cuss who sat me down and told me those most instructive four words I've ever heard since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, which sound just exactly like sit down, shut up. When he told me those, he told me what he wanted to know about me was what I was willing to do about my alcoholism. And then he proceeded, instead of lecturing me, to tell me about his drinking. And that's what we do to identify with one another. That's one of the things that was always completely different about what my mother or my ex-wives or long-suffering employers or girlfriends or whatever, they lectured me, and I couldn't hear them. It tells us somewhere, I think it's in the second step discussion in the 12 and 12, something to the effect of alcoholics by nature are defiant. One of the characteristics of the alcoholic is defiance. And I certainly had some of that still left. But by the time I got to AA willing to listen to you, I had pretty well drunk my defiance out of myself. Alcohol will do that to you if you're drunk of my type. That would be of the hopeless variety. I was fresh out of, defiance manifests itself in a number of different ways. For instance, Sam was nice enough to ask folks to turn off their cell phones and pagers. I didn't turn off my cell phone. I turned it down, but unfortunately that's also my watch, so in order to avoid boring you people to tears, I will be checking the time so that doesn't happen. And you can say thank you later. Like most folks, I guess I got born. And something was different fairly early on. I was a self-absorbed child. Periodically, I'll reflect on that, and things will become apparent to me. You know, the first item of self-absorption I can think of is being rather resentful when I heard my mother was expecting my little brother. And I wasn't going to be an only child anymore. And first thing I can remember, I guess I was probably about four, was shoplifting a candy bar out of a grocery store. And I've thought back on it, you know, why did I do that? And I figured I wanted the candy bar. And I figured if I asked Mom, the answer would be no. So what I want overrode everything I had been told. You don't take things that belong to other people. But I wanted it, so I took it, and I snuck it in my pocket, and I snuck home later and snuck around and ate the thing because if Ma had caught me, she'd, "Where did you get that candy bar, boy?" Of course, I probably would have lied about it had she caught me, but she didn't, and it was iffy as to whether or not I even considered that there would be consequences about it. I don't remember. I knew this wasn't the sort of thing I was supposed to do, but I did it anyway. And that pattern continued for another 35 years until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and actually had been sober for a little while and began to get the idea of trying to do what you people said and actually doing it for the proper reasons. A little bit of a slow learner sometimes, it seems. My first drink occurred, I was probably about 8 years old. My grandfather poured just a smidgen of whiskey in a water glass and filled it up with ginger ale or whatever soda was handy, and I was having a drink with the big folks. Dear old granddad thought you ought to learn how to drink like a gentleman at home. And, you know, I heard the drinking part and didn't hear the like a gentleman part. That rarely entered into my drinking. Our book refers to that. You know, if you can do the right about the face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to you. Well, I never got that drinking like a gentleman part down. I wasn't especially interested in being a gentleman anyway, as it turned out. I always felt different as a child. I never felt like I fit in. I never felt like I was part of the in crowd. I always tended to, at the same time, feel better than and worse than those people. I couldn't tell you where or why that comes from. You know, it's just like I can't tell you why it is I who is an alcoholic. I do know it doesn't matter. You know, what matters is that I know that I am one, which is good because, you know, that way, you know, thankfully we have a program of recovery around here for people like me who don't seem to fit into life, who seem to have an ongoing struggle, an ongoing conflict, who always seem to be a tad bit at odds against the world. You know, whether they actually are or whether they just feel like they are. Sometimes I was at odds with the world, you know, through my own thinking or through my own behavior, trying to get what I thought I wanted. But always I felt like the proverbial square peg in the round hole. I never felt like I was part of much of anything. I also had some other traits like perfectionism. And as I've since learned since I got sober, perfectionism basically breeds only one thing, and that one thing is failure. You know, today I've had an opportunity around Alcoholics Anonymous to come eyeball to eyeball both with my own humanity and my own hypocrisy. And having come eyeball to eyeball with the humanity part, of course, the best I can hope for is do the best that I can do within my given limitations. That seems to work. I know it works perfectly well in Alcoholics Anonymous. It seems to work well enough in life most of the time. And that, I think, is a good thing. It's good because that's the way it works. And, you know, the quicker I can embrace that and work within the way things are and get out of my own delusions, the quicker I'll feel less at odds with life and living and the people in the world around me. I did a lot of things most people do, went to school for a while until that got to be too big a struggle. College didn't suit me. Being told what to do didn't suit me. When I went off to college, basically I wanted to chase girls, drink beer, and experiment with drugs, not necessarily in that order. And they wanted me to do strange things like go to class, do homework, and take tests, and I didn't have any interest in that, so college and I parted company fairly quickly. I did what most guys did. I got a summer job after that fateful experience working construction. That's what a lot of guys do on summer break, and if that's the case, I've been on summer break for about 33 years now. You know, I'm still in the same industry, and, you know, it's an interesting industry. They'll have misfits like me. I tell people sometimes that we don't get the best and the brightest in that industry. We do get some good people, you know, but we also get some peculiar people, and I certainly are one most days. Less peculiar than I used to, however. The interesting thing about having gone to work in construction, I consider that to be pretty much the end of my amateur drinking career and the beginning of my professional drinking career. I had an opportunity to rub elbows with and bend elbows with some very hard-drinking individuals, and there was something cockeyed in my head that was perfectly content drinking just like they did. All my friends from early part of my life are gone from my life. and have been for a while. I didn't have that. I wasn't one of those people, as I mentioned. I didn't fit in well. I only had a few friends, and they are all long since gone because of my behavior. They didn't want to be like me. Some of those people drank like I did when I was young, you know, when we were that age. But they did strange things like grow up, get jobs, get married, buy houses. And I tried to do those things, but none of them ever seemed to work. You know, I've been married a couple of times, been divorced a couple of times. I was telling Bob while we were on the way up here, my sobriety date is at the end of the month. I got sober the last day of April of 1995. My last divorce was final in July of 1990. You know, so I'm going on divorce for 19 years, and you know, I have power over getting divorced. I cannot get married. I cannot take that first marriage. But I don't have any power over the first drink. I guess my first drinking problems actually did start while I was still in high school. My parents took exception when I would come home in their car and park it cockeyed in the driveway. And there would be whatever residue, the occasional pop top, back when beer cans had pop tops on them. Yeah, I know, it's hard to believe, isn't it? I was working on a job the other day. I found a couple of, working on an apartment, renovating an apartment complex. It was built in, probably in the late 60s. And underneath the stairwells in, we found some interesting residue. Uncrushed, unrusted steel beer cans. And on the bottom of them, it has the 2 cent Virginia sales tax stamp on them. And I found a 16-ounce Schlitz tall boy can the other day. Well, I took it home and cleaned it up, and it's currently sitting in with my bottle collection. Mostly milk bottles. Although there are a couple of booze bottles in there, too. Yeah, I find stuff and bring it home. But, you know, my parents took exception to my drinking. I had drinking problems with the woman who became my first wife. As a matter of fact, our first big argument after we got married was I wanted to drink and she didn't want me to. We were on our honeymoon. And that led to a screaming argument. I didn't take kindly to not getting what I want, and I wanted to drink. Needless to say, that marriage didn't last too long either. She asked me to move out. I did what I refer to as being, quote-unquote, the mature thing, and I packed my crap and went home to Mother's. Well, she had just recently thrown Dad out, so she had room. And then, of course, I did the next thing that a typical drunk like me, and it seemed perfectly sensible to me, I went and found another poor victim and married her. That one didn't last too long either. We did have a child, and fortunately today I do have a relationship with that child. I hope to touch on that a little bit as I go on later on. I still wasn't getting fired from jobs yet, but I had periods of time where I could moderate my drinking. My drinking was fairly varied at this point, but I had basically come to the conclusion that I was better off drinking beer because every time I tied into the whiskey, I got too darn drunk, too darn quick. And so, you know, I was already attempting to control my drinking by switching what I was drinking. You know, never taking a trip or not taking a drip or swearing off for any particular period of time. And any particular times I did stop drinking, it wasn't long before I did start drinking again. But by this time, it had already, and I'm in my mid-20s at this point, it had been a long time since I could predict, about the time I finished high school. I had lost the ability to predict what was going to happen once I started drinking. And what happened was those periods of blackouts and goofiness and consequences got to be more frequent and more uncomfortable. I did hold on to a few things to give me the illusion that I did not have a drinking problem. I had some preconceived notions about what an alcoholic looked like. You know, an alcoholic was a guy who showed up to work drunk or showed up to work or didn't show up to work because he was too drunk. And I always went to work. Now, there were a couple of reasons for that. One was, to protect this notion, and the other one was I needed the money. You know, I need to drink. I've got to buy the stuff. I need the money. And I'm sure that there were a lot of days where my employer did not get much of a day's work out of me because there wasn't a whole lot of me to produce one. But darn it all, I was there, for better or worse. And, you know, then I got to the point where I was hadn't stopped drinking that long, and there were the times where I did show up probably still drunk, not because I had been drinking that morning, but because I had been that drunk the night before. I remember one morning in particular having done that, and you know, thank God I let my coworker drive to the job site because we got pulled. You know, part of the load we had put on the back of the truck fell off the truck in the middle of 301 North, and that cop looked at me funny, but I wasn't driving. Wasn't anything he could say, and I wasn't acting like a jerk big enough to be drunk in public, so oh well. After my second marriage collapsed and I moved home to Mom's again, things got a little interesting at that point because I was getting to the point where my know-it-allness, my obnoxiousness, basically my behavior in general, I was having problems keeping jobs. And I got to the point where I started cycling through jobs fairly quickly. Now, I never outright got fired for my drunkenness. I usually got fired for being a jerk. And usually people didn't have a problem as long as I wasn't in a management position. If I was in a worker-type position, they didn't have a problem with my work. They had a problem with my behavior. And as I look back on it, my behavior was erratic. It was obnoxious. It was confrontational. Now, if you had asked me, I would have told you that I avoided confrontation. The truth of the matter is, if you confronted me about something, I would basically tell you where to head in and what I thought of you, probably in not too glossy or unflattering, or excuse me, not too, certainly glossy terms, and certainly not flattering terms. I was hard on those people around me. And there were many a resentment that I carried around. Bosses were always a good one to resent, and I couldn't tell you how many nights I sat on some bar stool in some bar, either with a co-worker or, in some cases, some stranger. Yeah, you ought to see that jerk I work for, and fill in the blank with the rest of the story. You know, some of this may sound familiar. But I was generally having a hard time getting along with people. I could always manage to charm some poor sick woman from time to time and keep a girlfriend around at least off and on for a while, you know, which somehow gave me some illusion of normalcy. But, you know, and if you had asked me at the time, I would have told you, yeah, you know, I've got a decent place to live. Well, my mother didn't throw me out. You know, bless her heart. And, you know, if you think about it, if you're still living at Mom's, you're kind of homeless in a way. But the biggest thing I was doing was glomming off somebody. And, you know, I was finding women to support me at some level. You know, a girlfriend to support me emotionally, my mother to support me at least partially economically, because she never charged me market rate to live at her house. And I spent a long time skating by. I guess at some point I had heard, I remember back in school, I guess it was somewhere in probably eighth or ninth grade, the first time I was ever, you know, ever decided to settle for mediocrity, and then was confronted by some teacher or administrator, who would say something like, you certainly don't measure up to your potential. Now, I'm sure the first time I was told that, I was probably shocked. And every time I ever heard that speech again, I got angry. I hated the "you're not living up to your potential, you have so much ability" speech. And of course, being the defiant type person I am, I'll show you, I'll live down to new lows. I won't even do as well as I'm doing now. You know, those B minuses can be C minuses in a hurry. And we can pick up the occasional F from time to time. I'll show you how bad it can be. You know, that was, if you said turn left, I turned right. That was just pretty much what I was going to do. And then go get drunk over it and talk about what a jerk you were. How dare you tell me what to do? I heard a guy speak once when I was about a year sober, about a year and a half sober. Darn good talk. And he said something to the effect that, "How dare you criticize me? That's my job. And besides, you're not doing it right." You know, because somewhere in the back of my head, I know how it really is. It hurts to go counter to the world like that. And it hurts enough that it'll make you real darn thirsty. You know, if you drink like I do and you have no control over it like I do, it'll make you really darn thirsty. And that's what you wind up doing about it. And of course, you know, I was by my early 30s, I was pretty much drifting. My mom was still putting me up, but I was doing odds and ends type work. I couldn't get anything that remotely looked like a white-collar type construction industry job, and I was actually happiest during that period of time working for a bunch of guys who, you know, if you saw them show up, you know, you might mistake them for Spanish Main type pirates. You know, guys with long hair and bandanas tied around their heads and ratty-looking clothing, and the only thing missing was the pirates and the cutlasses hanging off their belts and saying "arr" from time to time. It was a motley crew, and that bunch of guys, and it was a bunch of underachievers. I was the only guy on the crew who did not have a 4-year degree in some amazingly useless liberal arts field. And for those of you who have one of those, please accept my apologies, but you stuck with it, and I didn't. I got mad and quit. And, you know, nobody cared if you smoked pot on the job, and nobody cared if you started drinking before quitting time. You know, it was my kind of thing. But by this time also, you know, I started having scrapes with the law over my drinking. Well, since I was, you know, when I started drinking early on, I, you know, would swipe booze and drink in the woods. And something magical happens in the Commonwealth of Virginia when you turn 16. If you actually behave a little bit, you got a driver's license. And, you know, if your parents are as goofy as mine were, you get the keys to their car from time to time, and then you become a mobile drunk. And, you know, that was the way it went. And somehow the ideas of drinking and not driving left my head after the first several drinks. I would think, gee, you know, if I thought about not putting a key in an ignition switch after I'd been drinking, it meant I hadn't drunk enough. Because if I drank as much as Marshall wanted to drink, I didn't remember not to drive. And thank God, I never killed anybody, tore up a few vehicles, injured a few people, but never killed anybody, me included. And that's just by the grace of God and pure dumb luck. There's certainly no good reason for that. And, you know, those are always inconvenient. There's nothing that makes you feel good about having to make a phone call to get out of jail. It's certainly not the kind of thing I ever said to my first grade class when they stood us up in front of this class and said, well, what do you want to be when you grow up and what are your visions for yourself? And I wanted to say, you know, let's fast forward a little bit to the time I got here and say things like, I'm 37 years old. I live at my mother's. I finally gotten one crummy job that I'm getting ready to lose. I have a girlfriend who kicked me to the curb. I have two failed marriages. I have a child I pay child support for and grudgingly see from time to time, who does his best he can to put up with me, but basically is scared of me and whom I'm largely estranged from. I have one crummy vehicle I owe some money on and am behind on the payments with. I haven't got a driver's license from my last DUI. My phone never rings because basically everybody's gone. You know, the only phone call I could count on was hearing from General Motors Acceptance Corporation, where is last month's payment? You know, my life was a whole lot of empty. And I was sitting in my mother's basement with my feet on a crummy metal desk in a crummy old surplus sold chair, staring at a concrete block wall, and I became intimately familiar with the whole pattern of holes in the individual blocks in that wall, staring at that wall literally sometimes for hours, wondering how in hell it got to be this bad. Our literature says we will know loneliness such as few do. And that was the winter of 94-95, and that was indeed my last winter of discontent. I was suicidal. Now, I had been suicidal before, but I remember one weekend my mother was out of town. Somebody come and gotten her, and they had gone somewhere. Her car was sitting in the garage, and I had a lovely Beethoven tape and a piece of dryer hose and a couple of rolls of duct tape. And I was going to go tape some dryer hose to the exhaust pipe and run that in one window and tape it up and seal the car up and slip a little Beethoven in the tape player, crank the car up, and let her run. And this struck me as being an outstandingly good idea, followed by the abject fear that I would succeed in screwing this up too. My fear was that my brain would still work and I would do my body in and would wind up spending the rest of my life as a vegetable with fully functioning mental capacities. And that struck me as a fate worse than hell. I was totally hopeless at this time. Over the course of the years, I had tried to moderate my drinking. I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous a couple of times. Of course, the court sent me one time, and I actually dragged myself in once. I actually went to treatment back in 1984. My first wife had a bang-up good insurance policy. I decided I had a little problem with my drinky poo, and took a 4-week holiday on the insurance company. I think it cost us a whopping total of about $100. You know, I came home all fit as a fiddle. Oh, gee, all I have to do is just not drink. Well, the sad thing is, with me, when I just don't drink, I eventually drink. You know, I've heard some people say from time to time at meetings, well, just don't drink and go to meetings. Well, I tried that later on. I just didn't drink and went to meetings. And when I just don't drink and go to meetings, sooner or later, I drink. That's my experience. I've been there and done that. And, of course, the idea of controlling my drinking myself had long since gone out the window. I know I can't stay stopped. Now, while I was sitting there being miserable, the funny thing about it was I actually wasn't drinking at the time. What I had done was, when I got busted the last time, was I had gone and hired a shrink. And this well-meaning shrink, to whom I probably gave about that wee little bit of the truth and a whole lot of obfuscation, and probably a few misdirected type answers, generally known as lies to the real world, diagnosed me as being clinically depressed. Now, I've since come to realize that to the real world and to a lot of the medical community, alcoholics of my type look to have emotional and mental problems. We look sick in this manner to those people because we behave that way. You know, the real truth of that came to light not too long thereafter. But anyway, he promptly put me on not one, not two, but three antidepressants. So at this point, I'm not drinking. I'm taking these three antidepressants. I'm smoking all the non-habit-forming marijuana I can get my hands on all day, every day. And I spend my days at that last crummy job I had, and I spend my nights staring at that concrete block wall, and my phone never rings. And I've had to hire a guy to drive me around so I can do my job because I don't have a driver's license in my wrecked truck, which I tore up on that last night out, that last hurrah. That's what I look like when I'm not drinking. And I'm suicidal. But, you know, it's as it says in literature, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. Because part of what the court system made me do was I had to drag my butt back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here to tell you, I didn't want to go. I put it off till absolutely the last dying minute. And I finally, quick, rushed and went to those meetings that they required me to go to. I protected the chairperson's anonymity for each of those meetings that I attended by forging their signature on the bottom of my paperwork. You know, I didn't even think twice about it. That's just the way I did things. But I was also so antisocial at this time that I didn't want to go talk to them. But a funny thing happened while I was sitting in those meetings. It was I got exposed to you people. And a few of you seemed to have a little something going on. There were people who seemed to be, if not ecstatically happy, at least reasonably content. There were people who seemed not to be hating life. There were people who seemed to have some family life going on. They would at least make mention of this from time to time. They seemed to have some friends, because they were certainly standing around talking to one another, either over the coffee pot or out in the parking lot. And I felt as though I wasn't even in the room. But I did see and feel and sense a little bit of hope. And that perhaps, maybe, just maybe, in spite of my preconceived notions of what AA is and what AA is not, and what you are and what you are not, that I brought into those meetings with me, that maybe if I just took one more shot at it, something might happen. Thankfully, it did. Because I was fresh out of answers. I had gone through every bloody answer I could think of, and I remember during that time, it wasn't like I could sit down and have a linear train of thought. It was like I got bombarded by emotions and thoughts inside my head, and things would become apparent out of that, sometimes if I was lucky. Now, sometimes some of the things that would come apparent were absolutely insane, and that I always felt like one of the things that shrink scared me to death about was it dawned on me that if I told that man, I felt like if I told that man the truth, that I would wind up locked in a nut ward. You know, with one of those doors on one of those doorknobs that's a one-way deal. The knob's in the hall, and I'm on the other side of it. And I couldn't let that happen. So, on the last day of April, it was a Sunday of 1995, I got my butt out of a metal folding chair like one of these and walked up and picked up what I hope will be my last white chip. And as, you know, God willing, and I continue to do what you people ask of me to do, which isn't all that much and isn't all that unreasonable. And today, which is actually on my radar as being something I want to do, that can be the case. They told me strange things. They said things like, you don't have to drink again. They said things like, you don't have to hurt like this. They said it would get better. And I hoped against hope that, in fact, that would be the case. They also told me a few things, too. They told me I needed to get a sponsor. They told me I needed to read the big book. They told me I needed to find a God of my understanding. And, of course, they couched that in higher power terms. And that scared the hell out of me. I had been raised, my mother went to church most every Sunday of the world and dragged me along with it until I kind of declared war against the church when I was about 19, 20 years old and swore I'd never darken the door of a church again. And today I'm very grateful for churches because that's where they let us have our meetings. You know, and thank God they do. And I was about a week sober. I sat down and talked to this old guy who looked kind of like Santa Claus. I alluded to him before. He had a big old Santa Claus beard and long white hair and two eyes that didn't track each other. Come to find out later, he was blind in one of them, and he never looked at you while he was talking, and his eyes didn't track together, and they'd look at all kinds of strange things, and I could never figure out which eye I was talking to. And, you know, he told me things like, sit down and shut up, which was good because I needed to be told, sit down and shut up. And one of the things this guy had going for him was he was just rough enough around the edges, I figured he might take me if it came to that, and I did what he said. I listened to this man because he, you know, as he went on, he told me about his drinking. And I was able to compare his drinking to my drinking, and for the first time in my life, I started listening to somebody who wasn't lecturing me about my drinking. He was telling me a story. He was telling me the story of how he got to Alcoholics Anonymous and what he had done since he had been here. He had told me a story like our directions tell us, what we were like, what I am like, what happened, and what we are like, what I am like now. You know, not what it was like, what I am like. You know, it is variable. I am the constant, it seems, in that equation. I began to identify with this man. There were two basic lessons in what he told me. One of them was contained in the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And I could begin to see for the first time that it was about the drinking. Because that was what he wanted to hear about. The other part of what he was telling me is contained in our fifth tradition, you know, where it says that, you know, our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. I'm not quoting it exactly, but that's the gist of it. AA does one thing, and it does it very well. And granted, we all come in with stuff going on in our lives. You know, if we didn't have stuff going on in our lives, we might still have the illusion of manageability. But my life hadn't been manageable for years. And if I didn't have somebody managing it for me, my mother, a wife, a girlfriend, a dictatorial type employer, I was a total failure at doing it myself. It just didn't get done. And I, for the first time, was able to begin to get my head around this. My way just doesn't work. And I was actually willing to try yours. When I was about 2 weeks sober, a guy appointed himself my sponsor. Now, that was probably good because it probably would have been for a while before I ever actually got around to asking anybody to be my sponsor. He said, I'll be your sponsor. And I said, okay. And he said, There are two things you need to do. You need to read the big book and you need to find God. He didn't say higher power. He said, find God. Now, let me temper this story with this. That's what I heard him say. This guy was a militant card-carrying, if they issue cards, atheist. You know, he would sit up in meetings and say, you know, you can take your church God and stick him in your ear. I don't want to hear about it. But this man told me I needed to find God. And I swallowed kind of hard on that one. I knew you all were going to get around to sneaking that in on me sooner or later. I had heard you before. But he promptly tempered that statement with this. He said, but don't worry about that. Everything you need to know about God is contained in the first portion of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I finish up. You know, he may not have said that, but that's what I heard. He told me to get a big book and start reading it. Well, I had already gotten a book and had been reading it. And there's a sentence in chapter 4 where it says, when therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. And while this guy is telling me this, that sentence kind of formed an idea in my head. And all of a sudden it made sense, because that meant I did not have to swallow any dogma. That meant that I did not have to observe any church-like rules or regulations or anything like that. It meant that it was a God that came fairly broadly defined and fairly broadly, completely broadly based. And whereas the booze had, like I mentioned, the booze had beaten the defiance out of me, I could do business with that. You know, it wasn't like I'm beaten and I'm okay, you know, because I'm all mopey and stuff. I wasn't thrilled with the idea, but it wasn't objectionable. And I wasn't going to argue the point. I was actually willing to do what this man asked me to do in that regard. I was already going to a bunch of meetings at this point. By this time, I had discovered commuter meetings, so I was going to 2 meetings a day. When I was 32 days sober, I got canned from that last crummy job I could get and would be unemployed for the next 5 months. And that means I could do noon meetings, too, because I had time. And I still had that crummy truck, and I was still one step ahead of GMAC. So I could make a bunch of meetings, and I made a bunch of meetings. I'd find odds and ends work to do, and I trusted the process. I remember when I got fired from that job, I was angry. You know, I'm 30 days sober, I'm not drinking, and my default setting is to get angry at you and to come at you. If I think you're after me, you're going to get it back, and you're probably going to get both barrels. And I remember walking out of that little session, closing the man's door behind me, and looking down the hall, and I had heard something around AA that when one door closes, another one opens. Now, if I'd known it was going to be 5 months before I found gainful employment again, on some kind of predictable level, I might have driven to the liquor store instead of that midday meeting. As it was, I went to the midday meeting. Told this guy who had appointed himself my sponsor, who was there. He said, guess you better buy a newspaper and start reading the want ads, huh? Nobody ever said AA is not a practical program. It is. And, you know, the saying says God helps those who help themselves. The corollary of that statement that is unspoken is God doesn't seem really to help those all too much who won't help themselves. So, you know, that was pointed out to me a while later. I got another sponsor at about 6 months sober, and I did an inventory at about 8.5 or 9 months sober. And it wasn't a very good inventory, but it was a good enough inventory that I didn't drink. I went out and fumbled my way through some amends, you know, like our process says, and I fumbled. I screwed a few up, and there were a couple I've tried to make that I probably should have left alone. and they probably sounded more like a pathetic mumbling of I'm sorry than my looking somebody in the eye and saying, I was wrong, what can I do to make it right? I know the difference between those today. I went through a spell in middle sobriety. I did stay involved in service work. I remember my first bit of service work was I pitched in, offered to pitch in to help clean the men's room in the clubhouse in Southside Richmond. And that was an interesting bit of service work. I don't know what you learned doing it, but, you know, it's not something that anybody really wants to do, but it needs doing. And I gave guys rides to meetings. I was fairly good at showing up on stuff. I did kind of go through an egocentric point where I took on too many positions and was doing none of them very well, and they started falling by the wayside as people figured out I wasn't getting the job done and got somebody in to do it who would, which of course kind of bent me out of shape a little bit, but, you know, they did what they had to do. Nobody to blame on that one but me. But I finally took a service job. I got mad at my home group over something that was kind of ironic. My home group today is the same home group I got mad at then. It was the Jaywalkers group in Richmond. And when I got mad at that group and left it, it was one meeting a week and had maybe 8 people in the home group and probably 12 to 15 people at its once-a-week meetings. When I finally ate a bit of humble pie and went back to it, and they took me back about 5 years later, it was up to 3 meetings a week, and in the main closed discussion meeting on a Friday night, it might have 100 people sitting in it. So obviously they did just fine without my being there. Thank you very much. And they didn't laud it over my head. But I had taken up with this other group, and I got a coffee-making job that I wound up keeping for 4 years. And I wouldn't call it being angry at Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't. I still had some anger over a lot of stuff. I was still carrying a lot of resentment that was pretty much under my surface. A couple of them weren't. A couple of them were actually probably keeping me going. And I didn't have what you would consider to be a working relationship with God. I was bumping along. I had been going to 16, 20, 25 meetings a week when I was about 2.5, 3 years sober. And I was down literally by the time I was 5 years sober to 1 meeting a week, this one I had the coffee commitment at. The good news about that service commitment was I never got to the point where I quit going to meetings, which means I never achieved a disconnect with you people and with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm of the opinion that had I, the results would have been disastrous for me. And I limped along that way for about 3 years. I was self-sponsored there for a while. Then I had a guy, basically I could manipulate, sponsor in name only, and you know, somebody asked me, have you got a sponsor? Yeah. And, you know, we had, yeah, I'm his sponsor, yeah, he's my sponsor kind of thing. And, you know, it wasn't a lie, except it was. Because it wasn't a sponsor, for instance, in the relationship I have with my sponsor today. And I succeeded in getting slowly more miserable. I was engaged in some behavior which was crazier than some of the things I had done back while I was drinking. You know, I was sober chemically only. Because I was getting back to the point where I wasn't a real good guy to be around. I didn't behave as badly in many regards as I had back when I was drinking, but you know, I was not somebody to be proud of, and I was cultivating some resentments and feeling vindictive about some folks, and it was making me goofy. At about 8 years sober, I remember I was standing in my living room one day. I was living in an apartment in downtown Richmond, and it was a morning, and I was looking east out of one of the east-facing windows, and the thought went through my head for no particularly good reason. Boy, you may be cozying up on your next drink faster than you're putting distance between you and the last one. And that was a wake-up call, because I embraced that concept. Of course, I spent a couple of weeks thinking about it. And then I finally got off my dead butt and started doing something about it. And I started going back to meetings, and one of the meetings I started going back to was my old home group. And that's when I realized, oh, gee, how big this place has gotten. Guess they missed me not at all. And I had a difference of opinion with the guy who was my nominal sponsor. And I was doing a little work on the house of the guy who's my current sponsor. And we had been talking some. We had always been, not that we saw each other very frequently, especially when I wasn't around very much. But I asked him if he would be my sponsor at that point. And he said he would. And we actually sat down and went through this book. And we went through and did the steps like the book says do them. And that was the first time I had ever done that. And I would love to be able to say that, you know, it's transferred my life, and I know that I can stay sober forever, and I know that I'll be ecstatically happy forever. But that would be Mickey Mouse, because life continues to happen. That's fine. Life is supposed to happen. What I have today is a working knowledge of the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous, our spiritual program for our spiritual illness, and I've come to believe that today alcoholism is in fact a spiritual illness. I don't suffer from a mental problem, and I don't suffer from an emotional problem, even though it can look like it sometimes. I suffer from a spiritual problem. And it's very simple. I know that that's true because when I apply spiritual principles to it, the problem ceases to be a problem. And I don't know how much more scientific you can get with a conclusion than that. I've got a good working relationship with my mother today. I've got a good working relationship with my family today. I'd mentioned my son earlier. You know, we've got a good relationship. He lives in Florida, is getting ready to graduate from college, and Mom and I are flying down 1st of May to watch him graduate. He's been having a lot of fun lately. He's been a bat boy for the Tampa Bay Rays. This is his third season starting up. Their first home game is next Monday and against those dreaded Yankees. And he's having a ball doing that. You know, he tells me, yeah, the players tease him, and he gives them a raft of crap back, and it's really funny to listen to him tell me these stories, because, you know, we have a relationship. I can actually be there and hear these kinds of things. He gave me a World Series baseball for Christmas from their failed series attempt last fall. But, hey, you know, it was still the worst to second story, so that's pretty darn good. And today I've got more people in my life than I've ever had. I have a working friendship with people both in the program and out of the program. And, you know, my phone rings routinely, you know, even if it's just somebody just to talk. But, you know, the weirdest thing happens sometimes. People will call me up from time to time just to see how I'm doing. And that is a far cry from 14 years ago, where that literally never happened. So, you know, the moral of the story is, if you're sitting there and you're feeling like, you know, your life is in the toilet, and you know, all you do every time you try to climb out of the thing is slip back into it, and you think your drinking might have something to do with it, give this thing a try. You know, what have you got to lose except your misery, basically? You know, I may not be ecstatically happy and outrageously joyous and you know, free as a bird, but I'm certainly not the sad, miserable, caged thing I was when I got here. Thank you.